This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. South African satirist Peter Dirk Ace describes himself as a middle-aged, fat, bald, Afrikaner Jewish drag queen from Cape Town. Apartheid used to be the target of his humor, but as he says, what's the point of satire when you've won? He was so happy when apartheid ended in 1994, he hardly minded being put out of business. So he took time off from political satire. It wasn't racism or democracy that brought him back. It was a virus, HIV. South Africa is one of the countries most hard hit by the epidemic. He says he realized that without confronting HIV/AIDS, he would either die of it or die of the fear of it. In his shows, he talks about the virus, and he also goes to schools in South Africa to talk to students about safe sex. Last month, he won a special citation from the Obie Awards, the Off-Broadway Theater Awards, for his one-man show Foreign AIDS, which he had performed in New York. I spoke to him from London, where he was concluding a run on the West End before heading to Dublin to perform Foreign AIDS. Peter Dirk Ace, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, as a satirist, what are some of the problems you've had talking about sex and AIDS? I mean, apartheid was pretty loaded to talk about. Certainly risk talking about apartheid. But I think there are still problems that come with talking about sex and AIDS, although they are different problems.
It is incredibly complicated because one suddenly realizes that apartheid was a very easy target in comparison. There were good guys and bad guys under apartheid, black against white, good against evil. And yet the simplicity meant that four-year-old kids could wear the T-shirt, down with apartheid. I think we were the last political T-shirt. I haven't seen one since then. When it comes to HIV/AIDS, it's virus versus us. We don't really have good guys and bad guys here. We've got frightened people. And some of us are more frightened than others. And among those, I include our president, Thabo Mbeki, and many members of the government who are actually turning away from the issue of HIV/AIDS. So it is a frightening target because it is based not in health specifically, but based in sex. And there we come to the problem. How does one confront the minefield of HIV/AIDS? How does one talk about sex to school kids? How do you use the words that aren't allowed to be used at school? Teachers can't use those words. Politicians don't use those words. But I come from nowhere. I'm just an entertainer. I've been doing crazy things. The kids think I'm mad and they think I'm 12 years old. And so I found a way of talking to them in their own language. It is a constant work in progress. There is no answer to anything, just questions all the time.
Are there things that you say? I know you do a lot of performances in schools. Are there things that you say and words that you use that principals and teachers have objected to, or parents?
Well, in the beginning, I stumbled into this with total instinct leading me. I just realized I had to do something to confront my own fear. And to be honest, as a satirist, if I'm going to reflect my country, I've got to reflect my own fear, my own terror of a virus, which could so easily become a part of my life if I am not careful, which I'm not always. Anyway, so I went straight to the schools and I said, it's a one-hour show, it's free, words are used. Now, some principals came back and said, what are the words? I said, no, you must invite me and I'll show you the words. But yes or no? Well, most of them said yes. Yes, to actually confront some of the negative criticisms, for the first few months, that's all I got. Letters to the papers, people accusing me of using filthy language, of abusing my freedom of speech, of being a pedophiliac. I mean, God, words that I had to look up in a dictionary. Then it changed. Then the young people started defending me. The kids wrote letters. The kids started talking. Some parents started saying that this has changed their children's lives, that the children have come home and they've started talking about the things that they as parents didn't know how to approach. And now 4 years later, after 500 schools and a million young South Africans, I regard negative criticism as just a part of the fear that I'm trying to confront with humor. So it doesn't frighten me anymore.
Now, you're gay. If you were doing this in the United States, you know, touring schools, talking frankly about safe sex, then there would be certain schools where teachers or principals or parents would be saying, no, we can't allow a gay man to come into the school and talk about sex in any way because, you know, those gay people, they come to the young people to recruit and to convert them. Do you run into that kind of view in South Africa?
I have never been confronted with that. Isn't that extraordinary? I've never thought of it like you've just put it to me, because maybe it's an American point of view. We have a constitution, which is probably the most important thing in our democracy. It's a constitution that protects everybody. Every single human is protected by the constitution as an equal, meaning gays and lesbians are treated equally as married couples, as heterosexual people are. And as a gay man, I've been liberated by Nelson Mandela. I always say that he freed me from jail. I didn't free him. And being gay is a job description. You know, I'm overweight, I haven't got hair, I love Sophia Loren, and I'm gay. Okay, that's a job description. There's no big deal. So when I go to the schools, the kids know. I'm very, very open with this. I mean, I start my talk to them without using the word gay. I just make them very aware that I do cut out pictures of David Beckham rather than pictures of Madonna. Well, then again, Madonna is quite a drag queen, so I don't mind that. No, I make it very clear. And, you know, nobody's ever confronted me, because I also talk about gay sex. I also talk about anal sex to the kids. I say to the boys, you have no right to rape the girls. And I say to the girls, you have no right to rape the boys. And then I say to the boys, you've got no right to rape each other. And anybody who is forced into a sexual compromise has the right to stand up and point out who did it. You know, so the first 20 minutes of my talk to the kids doesn't even involve HIV. It involves democracy, and it is focused on fear. I think that is the main motivation. If we can laugh at our fear and make that fear less fearful, then we can actually confront the reason behind the fear.
Do you find that the children sometimes have the questions, but they don't quite have the language? Or do you find that most of the children really know a lot more than the adults might suspect?
Yes, the kids are far ahead. The kids are far ahead with their dreams. The kids I've been speaking to, I call the born frees. They come from a background which does not have apartheid as part of their fear. They want to become the kings of their castles. I mean, that's the great inspiration. These kids want to just go right to the gold crown. And I just have to say to them, you can, because this is a democracy. But if you are careless, you will get a virus. It'll slow you down. It might kill you. You won't be able to use your 100% energy. So know that you're in charge of your lives. They have heard about everything. I must say that in South Africa, everybody knows about HIV/AIDS. Nobody can say we don't know what's going on. Whereas here in the United Kingdom, very few people know anything. And frankly, in my experience in America also, it has become a very sort of marginalized reality. But in South Africa, they know about the virus. There is a virus called HIV, which, well, question mark, does it lead to AIDS? Our president questioned that, and now the confusion has led to even more complications. But they know about condoms, but now the irony is they've never seen one. They know they must use condoms, but they don't know what to do. Now, I have to take out a condom and show them. If you open it, you can actually tear it with your nail. It's a very fragile thing. You must practice. You know, I say, go and practice safe sex. Go into your room, drop your pants, put on the condom, and practice. You've got to do it properly, otherwise you make a mistake. And of course, there's a huge amount of humor in sex. People laugh. The kids love it. And when I use the words, I only use the words once. I don't use them twice. It's not a sort of a celebration of rude swear words. It's actually using words to combat the fear of where the minefield is.
Now, I want to just back up a step. You said that under South Africa's new constitution, gays have equal rights in everything, including the right to marry, and equal rights within that marriage.
Yes.
What's it like now for you to look at America, which prides itself on its constitution, which prides itself on democracy, which wants to export its democracy, knowing that in America, gay people are struggling for that right to marry, whereas in South Africa, they have it already. In your country,
yes,
you got it.
Well, you know, you've gone a long way since your constitution was created. And unfortunately, when I think of American constitutional rights, I think about all the amendments. It seems to be there's always an amendment to cancel out what was there earlier on. We haven't got to amendments yet. I'm very worried about what is happening in the world led by America, because I do recognize a fear that created the atmosphere of the 80s in South Africa under P.W. Botha and under apartheid. He said to us very clearly, I will protect you against the terrorists. And we said to him, yes, please take our human rights and do what you think is fit. And so he cut our foot to fit his shoe. And it needed the birth of our democracy, thanks to Mandela and the African National Congress, to actually bring back our human rights. They wrote the constitution. We have a government at the moment that is proud of what they did, because they did a very fine job. We have problems within the government, with HIV/AIDS and with Zimbabwe, but I celebrate my freedom of speech, through which I can criticize my government and accuse my president of genocide. It is an extraordinary contradiction in terms. But America is a very interesting lesson on how easily we can lose the way when we are frightened. So it's back to fear.
One of the places where politics and AIDS meet in your performances is through Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, who has said in the past that he didn't believe that HIV caused AIDS or that they were connected in any way. What's his latest position on that?
I wished I had answers here. He also recently said in an interview with the Washington Post that he didn't know anybody who had HIV and didn't know anybody who died of AIDS. It was such a shocking thing to hear from a leader of a country in which millions of people are affected by the virus, in which we lose 600 people a day because of government carelessness, a country in which the president's staff has died of AIDS. However, there's nothing we can do about that here other than just to say it is a huge problem. And in Africa, the leader is the chief. I am very much proud of being an African who happens not to be black, but I'm an African, who happens not to be Zulu, I'm an Afrikaner, but still an African. And I need to follow my leader in the structure of African tradition. And I know that Thabo Mbeki's confusion has just confused the people to the extent that they don't know what's going on out there. Recently, he has stopped talking about it. In fact, to the extent that during the election campaign in April, which he delivered brilliantly, with great aplomb and great visibility and a great relaxed embrace of the people, the media and everybody was told very clearly, you do not ask the president about HIV/AIDS. Now, that is like saying you don't ask President Bush about Iraq. Well, I don't know how close you are to that, but I don't think it's there yet. And so we are not helped by a president who embraces, who leads by putting his arms around, like, for example, Princess Diana, Princess of Wales, who in the 80s, went into a hospital and put her arms around a man who was dying of AIDS. And she did it without a mask over her face and without gloves on. And I think through that, she changed millions and millions of people's terror of this virus. She made it very clear that you can live with AIDS, don't have to run away from it. And Thabo Mbeki doesn't do that. And I am very upset by that.
Now, what about drugs? I know that there have been attempts to get affordable drugs or free drugs to people with AIDS in South Africa. Where do you think your country is on that now?
Well, for a long time, there's been an enormous amount of promises undelivered on the rollout of antiretroviral drugs. The realities around drugs are extremely complex. They are, first of all, terribly expensive. They shouldn't be. They don't have to be. But secondly, they're very complicated. You can't just swallow them like a Disprin. You have to have a certain regime and a discipline and an education. And so, yes, one does agree that it is complicated. Recently with the election campaign, the drugs were rolled out. I use that word in inverted commas. Rolled out in principle by the government, who said that within 5 years, these drugs will be available. In 5 years, we've lost 10 million people. So it's being used very much as an election ploy. It is very unsatisfactory. It is, in fact, not happening. The spin is happening. And again, with our new era of communication and information, people just have to hear the word, we are doing it, to believe it, and then they switch over to another program. So, unfortunately, it is not helping that the media move on to other problems and don't stick to this one issue and say, but prove to us, where are the drugs? My point is, yes, the drugs are important, but why do we have to make everybody think they'll have to take the drugs? I want to go right back to square one and say, you don't need to get the virus. The whole point is, it's only a virus. It's not a bomb in a train in Madrid. It's not a terrorist act. It's a virus without a cure. It's a virus that doesn't happen through your ear or through breathing. It is a virus that happens through sex. As I say, it comes when we come. So you've got to confront that, and you've got to know where the alphabet of survival is. Now, that is where the government is just looking away.
I know after the end of apartheid, you felt a little uncomfortable caricaturing the new leaders of the government because you thought as a white man it might seem racist if you were caricaturing the new black African leaders of your country. But in your show, I'm sure you want to talk about President Mbeki,
Yes.
Who is black. But, yes. But this has nothing to do with race, what you're talking about. This has to do with his policy on AIDS. So how do you feel about criticizing Mbeki or caricaturing President Mbeki in your shows?
Well, first of all, starting with Nelson Mandela, I mean, to do Nelson Mandela in a satire is like doing Mother Teresa in drag. You know, it was quite tough.
Right.
And I do him with enormous love. I love him so much, words cannot describe, as with Desmond Tutu. They have just been the most extraordinary gift of guardian angelship, which is just extraordinary. Although I must do them in the show. They have actually asked. Desmond Tutu has said to me, why am I not in your show? And of course I do him. And of course Nelson Mandela, who enjoys my impersonation when I do, ah, Peter, where is Evita? I have a wonderful relationship with these. And again, it doesn't come to, you know, color doesn't come into it. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Winnie Mandela, also a great character, a great a person as opposed to a black person. However, Thabo Mbeki, I did him originally in Foreign Aids as a sort of a send-up of a Shakespearean character, Lord Macbeki, as in Lord Macbeth. He Thabo Mbeki does a lot of quoting from Shakespeare because he was educated in the United Kingdom. He knows his Shakespeare, although he tends to mix things up, which makes for good material. But now I do him as a ventriloquist doll. I have a little doll as Thabo Mbeki, and I do a sketch with P.W. Botha, the leader of the apartheid regime, now talks to Thabo Mbeki because actually the name Thabo is an anagram for the name Botha. And P.W. Botha says, Thabo, just would you tell me, how is it possible that you've been responsible for the deaths of more blacks than I was? And then Thabo Mbeki says, no, we are not responsible for their deaths. We let them die by themselves. We ignore them and they go away. It's a shocking thing. But because it is so theatrical, because I've got a little ventriloquist dummy, the audience enjoys the theatrical part. And when the PW character says to Thabo, what do you call this final solution? Do you call it genocide? And then Thabo says, no, we call it democracy. That ends the new show. And it sort of makes people sort of take a deep breath. And I get into trouble. Of course I do. Party members, ANC party members, are angry with me for crossing the party line, for criticizing, and I say, excuse me, we are in a democracy. We have freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. Answer my questions. Why are we in denial from a presidential point of view? Answer that question. Otherwise, I'll make up the answers. I will say, has Thabo Mbeki got AIDS? Is he in denial because of that? Is this a genocidal way to save money so that the people who stay behind will have an easier country to run? Is this a new apartheid? People with money will be able to afford antiretroviral drugs, and people without money, the majority of our people, will die. Answer the questions. At the moment, there's no answer, so I've got to create my own theatrical minefield and put up some balloons here.
Do you think that President Mbeki is surprised at being the target of the satire of somebody who was so anti-apartheid?
I hope so. I must tell you, I knew him quite well when he was deputy president.
Because you did.
When Nelson Mandela went away doing all the things that he did, holding Bill Clinton's hand in those days and saying, don't worry, Bill, you know, it's only human. Thabo Mbeki used to invite me to his dinners to do a cabaret, 10-minute slots. And he used to say to me, don't do P.W. Botha, don't do the easy things. Do me, do us, show us how to laugh at ourselves. Thabo Mbeki was brought up on Not the 9 o'clock News, on Monty Python, on all those wonderful British alphabets of satire. And I was dazzled by the support from this bright man. He wore the red ribbon, the anti-AIDS ribbon. I was dazzled by the fact that he actually was there, visibly on our side. And then something went wrong. I don't know what went wrong. Suddenly, he just changed gear and went off on his own. So if he's uncomfortable with me, well, tough. My passion is my country. My passion is my enormous respect for where we are, my democracy. The young people, I've been to a million kids, and I can tell you, if we can keep our kids alive, we will have the greatest generation the world has ever seen. Americans will move to South Africa, but we must keep them alive today, because tonight they'll have a party, and sex is a very seductive thing, and before you know it, you're doing it. And you just think, oh, well, I can't get the virus because it can't happen to me. Well, it can. And it can happen to a president and a pop star, and me and you. So I have to focus on the broader picture and not apologize for being rude to the leader of my land.
Peter, one of the characters that you do in your shows, and a character that you've been doing for years, is Evita Bezuidenhout, who's
yes.
an Afrikaner matron. She used to be married to a nationalist member of parliament. would you just describe her a little bit and tell us how she has been responding to AIDS in South Africa?
Well, first of all, let me give you a sort of an American picture. Phyllis Schlafly on the one side, Nancy Reagan on the other side, Eva Braun, Imelda Marcos, Minnie Mouse, inspired by beauty like Sophia Loren's makeup, inspired by incredible focus like Mrs. Clinton. But the thing about Evita Bezuidenhout, she's not Dame Edna. I mean, I've always had this comparison. People have said Evita Bezuidenhout is South Africa's answer to Dame Edna Everidge. And my answer to that is, well, what was the question? And the only similarity between Barry Humphries, the Australian satirist, and me is that we're middle-aged men with good legs. Evita's a political beast, a dangerous political beast. And of course, during the apartheid era, she was a supporter of the government. She was an ambassador in one of the black homelands. Reputedly, she was having an affair with our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister Pik Buerta, to the extent that he started believing it. He used to send her emails. Now, how do I explain this to you? This man used to send emails to Evita Bezuidenhout and get sexy with her, but he would care of Peter Dirk Ace. I mean, he knew it was me. I mean, surrealism became a way of life for me during those years. And of course, when the new government happened, Evita was in opposition. Now she is very much a designer Democrat. She cooks for the government. She is somebody who believes that if people eat together, they must talk together. So she prepares dishes for the ANC to try and get Robert Mugabe around the table to try and find out why he is creating a genocide in his country. Evita's very tempted to put Valiums in his orange juice and get him out of the house and into a box and put him under the ground. But, you know, she has no sense of humor, no sense of irony, which makes her a very, very important clown figure. Because if I said the things that she says, for example, Evita says, during apartheid, we used to put all our political prisoners on Robben Island. Now George Bush has followed our example, and he puts his political prisoners on Cuba. So I'm using an enormous amount of information from our racist and fascist and totalitarian past to sadly reflect the state of very important, dignified democracies in 2004.
Is Evita talking at all about AIDS?
Yeah. Now, she comes with me. When I go to the schools, she's one of the characters I do because the kids know her more than me. And I say to her, do you want to see Evita? Yes! Now, these are 2,000 black kids in a township in the middle of nowhere sitting on the cement floor. You want to see Evita? Yes! Shall I bring her to you? Yes! And so out comes the lipstick, and I put on the lipstick. Well, they first of all nearly have a heart attack with excitement.
Wait. When you put on the lipstick, are you facing them? Or?
I'm facing them. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And I'm rolling on this lipstick. I mean, you know, boy, George, eat your heart out. And they scream with delight because this middle-aged, bald, fat man is putting on lipstick. And then I put on tinted glasses because I haven't got time for eyelashes. And I put on big earrings. And I put on a poncho, which gives the idea of a dress. And then I say, Is she here? No. I said, what's missing? The hair. Ah, there. So I put on the hair. I turn around so that my back's to them. Put on the wig. Give a beat or two. Turn around. And there she is. And of course, they do somersaults with delight. So the wonderful magical theater works for them. And of course, she, in fact, says to them, like all conservative people say to them, No, you're too young to have sex. You must play soccer and football, and you must play with your dolls and wait till you get married before you have sex. And I mean, rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. You know, kids don't want to hear that because sex happens around the corner at the age of 10. So she is very much reflecting that sort of prejudice in their lives. But the fact is that her little grandchildren say to her, what is all this about the AIDS? So she's got to answer their questions. And her son, De Kock, now she's got twin sons, De Kock Bezuidenhout, who is gay, and Izan, who is a Nazi. Now, interestingly, the name Izan, when you put that name in a mirror, it reads Nazi. I mean, N-A-Z-I-I-Z-A-N. And of course, De Kock is very involved with the AIDS program and reality because his best friend, his lover, has got HIV, which Evita doesn't know. And Evita's very offended by this because she's an Afrikaner, she's a Christian, she's white. It can't happen to her. It can only happen to poor blacks. But her son has been very specific in saying to her, Mama, you must talk about this. You must help people identify with the fact that AIDS is part of life. And then she says to him, De Kock, why are you so involved with this horrible AIDS? And then he says, Mama, because I'm positive. And so I said, well, if you think you know what you're doing, I'm not going to argue. So you see, one takes her through that denial area where she represents, I mean, 60% of my audience, white and black. And so she is very nervous about it. But her sister, Bambi Kellerman, who is a blonde, grand horizontal, a real tarty woman, very Marlene Dietrich, because she went to Germany and she married a Nazi, but she didn't know he was a Nazi because she was an Afrikaner. I mean, what was the difference as far as she was concerned? And of course, she had to become a stripper. And of course, when he eventually died as Minister of War in Paraguay, she's now back in South Africa running a brothel, and she's got his ashes in an urn, and she has AIDS. But as she said, she's got the money, she can afford the drugs, and she flies to London and gets it free on her old national health card. So wherever I can, I use my characters to confront issues. You know, just going back to what you said earlier on, do I feel racist when I do black characters who are politicians? Yes, I do. But what I rather do, instead of doing the Minister of Health, who needs to be done very firmly, I rather do somebody in the health area like a nurse or a doctor to reflect what is happening, rather than actually become a sort of an Uncle Tom character done by a white man with black accent. I don't feel comfortable with that. And people are right to say, if they don't have a background, it's racist. When I once did my performance at one of Nelson Mandela's AIDS awareness dinner parties to raise money for AIDS orphans, Oprah Winfrey was a guest. And Evita refers to her as Comrade Winfrey. And I must say, she was very, very uncomfortable for the first 3 minutes of Evita's cabaret, where Evita was saying to Nelson Mandela, we apologize for apartheid. We're very, very sorry it didn't work. And Oprah took some very deep breaths and swallows until she saw that Nelson Mandela was falling off his chair. He was roaring with laughter. So Oprah understood that the great celebration of where we are is that our former convicts, our former prisoners, our former victims are people with a great sense of humor. Again, sense of humor, that is the key. That has been my inspiration through my life. And now, with my friends who are dying of a virus, I am no longer frightened of sitting next to them and holding their hands and kissing them and hugging them. I wouldn't go there 5 years ago because of my terror, but I can do it now. And their extraordinary humor, where they say to me, let's plan the funeral. I mean, you know, it takes an enormous amount of courage and humanity to be able to get there.
How many people would you estimate you know who have died of AIDS?
I don't know. I don't count. I just miss them. I don't count. I don't count. I can't count because I'm wrong. Because if we're losing 600 people a day, that's a lot of people. You know, I keep on, when I talk to the kids in South Africa, because they've seen it on television so often, I remind them of 9/11. First of all, I say, you know, 3,300 people died on that terrible day. And yet on that terrible day, 3,300 people died in South Africa of AIDS. And the next day, 3,300 people died of AIDS. And the next day, and every single day since 9/11, we've lost the same amount of people every day. And also the image of an aeroplane crashing into a building. And I say to them, we are buildings. We are skyscrapers of passion and energy. We are the towers that were there. And the HIV virus is like a hijacked plane filled with petrol that goes into us and explodes. And that's our immune system. And we collapse. You've seen it on television. But it's happening among us. But we can't see it. But we must understand it. So images are very important, very important.
How does post-apartheid South Africa compare with your expectations? It was something that you were hoping for, you know, for so long, and now that you're several years into it, how does it compare?
Well, you know, I never thought we'd get here. I never thought we would have a democracy. I expected a Holocaust on the lines of Rwanda or Kosovo or Berlin in 45, because, dear God, we needed to be punished for what we did. But we got away with it. I mean, Nelson Mandela came out and said, no, I'll give you your second chance. Let's do it together. So I must tell you, I'm hugely in a feeling of celebration. I am very aware, not to demean the fact that violence is totally out of control. People are dying because of carelessness. There should be much more focus on paying policemen, and we must look after ourselves, but it can be done. We have done an enormous amount in 10 years beyond expectations. We are a healthy young democracy, and we've had a very boring third election, which is great. We actually counted our votes in 48 hours, and we're a third world country. We're not Florida. And that was great. So I'm an optimist. I always want to say my glass will always be half full, not half empty.
Now, you know, your character, Avita Bezuidenhout, is an example of, a white matron who supported apartheid, and now you've tried to trace her as she's adapting to the democratic majority-ruled country she lives in. What about real people who you know who supported apartheid? Have you watched them try to change in the new country?
Enormously, and it's an extraordinary one. Example: recently, I was in a black township, and my friend said, "Just look over there," and there was a Mercedes Benz with the boot of the back of the car was open, and there was a lady like Evita, with grey hair, very well coiffured. She'd been to the hairdresser. She was the sort of Afrikaans white woman who voted for apartheid, and she was actually allowing the children to take trays of food out of her car into their little house because she'd adopted those little families because they didn't have parents because of AIDS. And when I went up to her, she shouted at me. She said, "Stay away. I don't like you. I don't like what you did to us Afrikaners." So she's not my friend, but she was doing this extraordinary gift of compassion and help to the future. So I have a great respect for what people are doing out of their hearts and just out of their heads.
I want to ask you a little bit about your family and your background. Your father's family is Afrikaner.
Yes.
And your mother's family is Jewish, but you didn't know that until after her death. She fled Germany after Hitler came to power. She had converted to Christianity and moved to South Africa. And you know, when I read that, I was thinking, that's probably the wrong place to have fled to. I mean, you, like in your show, you make so many comparisons between, you know, the Afrikaners and the Nazis just in terms of their kind of racist ideology. Why do you think she came to South Africa?
Well, I think we must also remember that other countries didn't want the Jews. America and Britain were already starting to say no. And it was,
of course, apartheid wasn't officially in place yet.
No, apartheid only started in 48. And my mother, her brother had gone out to South Africa some years before. And she was a concert pianist. Anyway, she went out there and she met my father on the stage of the City Hall when they were doing a concert, Mozart concerto together.
Oh.
But Afrikaners aren't known to like anybody. So I don't think anybody who escaped sort of anti-Semitism wants to sort of announce themselves to anti-Semitic people. I find it very difficult to explain why, although I do understand why she didn't want to confront that. The pain must have been terrible. The loss must have been terrible. We are now retracing the history of my mother's family. An extraordinary story, her piano, which she brought from Berlin in 37, which was at home. My sister's a concert pianist, and this piano has been our touchstone and our sort of heartbeat for all these years, has now gone back to Berlin. It's going into the Jewish Museum. And my sister will be playing a recital on her mother's piano in Berlin. And that's the sort of the story that Spielberg makes us cry about, and it's happening in my own family. So I salute all that background that I'm now discovering at the age of 59.
How into Afrikaner ideology was your father?
My father was a very decent, kind, wonderful man. And he was an Afrikaner who was terrified of anything that was not acknowledged by his tribe, meaning black people as people. Although, again, we were not allowed racism in the house because my mother made it very clear that she wouldn't stand for it. And as things changed, my father changed with them with great shock and then great awe and then great enjoyment. When I brought a black actress into our house in the late 80s and she went up to my father and she said, "Hello, Pa, darling," and kissed him on his lips, I thought he'd have a heart attack. But within 2 weeks, he was kissing her back. So, you know, again, just deflating that terror and that fear. And we fought like hell in the 70s. He hated what I was doing. He threw me out of the house because within the framework of being an Afrikaner, I was a terrorist and a communist. And then he found out that I wasn't, and that the people that he believed were liars. And so we became very good friends.
Do you think your father knew that your mother was actually Jewish?
Well, you know, when I did once ask him, he said, "No, she was a Catholic." I said, "But isn't that worse for an Afrikaner?" You know. And then we laughed and didn't go there. He didn't. My mother died very tragically. She committed suicide, and really one didn't want to go anywhere that would cause him pain. So we didn't talk about those things.
How did you find out what her background really was?
Through her brother, who survived her. through my sister's extraordinary, I suppose, her looking into backgrounds and reading the letters. Being German, my mother wrote letters to her friends, kept copies of the letters. Her friends kept copies. We have got correspondence that goes back to 1935. An extraordinary life in which I see a mother that I never knew. And I'm, you know, I just lost her very young. I was very young when she died, so I don't know how she would have enjoyed what I'm doing, although she always said I'd be a writer. And so my sister is really becoming the archivist of the family, and she's showing me an enormous amount of detail that I had no idea about. Although instinctively I knew I was Jewish because I just always loved my Jewish friends and the Jewish food, the Jewish humor, the extraordinary capacity for self-mockery. And I'm proud to be part of that. And I'm proud to be an Afrikaner, so I belong to both chosen people.
Why are you proud to be an Afrikaner?
Well, I am. You know, it'd be terrible to tell you now at the age of 59 I'm ashamed of my roots. I am an Afrikaner. Whatever my people have done, I will not walk away and pretend I'm not part of that. I am part of that. And I will use the guilt that I've inherited to actually make sure it doesn't happen again. And humor is a great shield.
Now, you have your own theater now in South Africa, is that right?
I've moved to a little town 100 kilometers west of Cape Town called Darling. It's wonderful to live in a place called Darling. And people say, yes, Darling, where Darling? I said, in Darling, Darling. I've taken over the little railway station. It's very much sort of like a little Baghdad cafe, and turned it into two theaters, a restaurant and a bar, and an art gallery and an art school for the little kids in the community, and a piano school. And we have a huge involvement with our community kids. We've got 1,500 kids under the age of 16, street children that we look after, and an enormous inspiration with them. And that's where I am. And Evita Besaidnout is based there. It's called Evita Se Perron. And of course, Perron is the Afrikaans word for station platform. And it's become a sort of a, you know, people come, tourists come from all over the world because we've got an exhibition of all the terrible symbols of apartheid, the whites only signs, all the pictures of Verwoerd and the apartheid regime. We call it a museum. We call it a nauseum. It is definitely a Disneyland of bad taste because people come and laugh at their fear. That's back to where we were right in the beginning, laugh at fear.
You got a Truth and Reconciliation Award a couple of years ago, was it?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Was that from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yes, from Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the commission. And it was a great, great embrace. Very, very important for me. Because those two things are, I suppose, the most important aspects of the democracy. The truth of the past, the truth about the future, meaning the good news and the bad news, and the reconciliation where people are actually embracing each other and going forward to make it work for everybody.
What did the citation say?
The citation said, I can't remember, but it said something like somebody who actually used humor to reflect fear and used entertainment to educate and has not actually got out of the tree. I mean, I feel like I'm an old queen up a tree throwing tomatoes at the politicians, you know, so maybe that's where I'll end up, you know. it was a great tribute. But then I must tell you, Evita Besaidnout also got an award in San Diego. She got the Living Legacy 2000 Award. And that award had been given in the past to Mother Teresa, Princess Diana, and Hillary Clinton. And frankly, when I found out that Evita was getting the award, I did phone them from South Africa, and I said, thank you so much, but do you realize that Evita Besaidnout does not exist? And the lady said, honey, you know, to be a legend, you don't have to exist, you just have to be. And it was a wonderful thing because there were 30 awards that night to very, very significant women who'd done an enormous amount for women all over the world. And the 31st award was to Evita. And there she was on stage looking just glorious. And she said, thank you for this wonderful award. It's the only award that Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu can't get because they're not a woman like me.
This is a drag performer's dream come true, isn't it?
I say, absolutely. I mean, with politicians writing all my material and having some wonderful women to have as inspirations. And being an actor. You know, I keep on saying it's my job. You know, it's got nothing to do with actually drag or being transsexual. It's me doing a job, and the fact that I've got good legs helps. and I say if I had to play a tree, I'd play a damn good tree. And if I've played a cat and a dog already, and then maybe I've played a stone. So it's my job.
Well, Peter Dirk, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Peter Dirk Ace is a South African satirist. He'll be back in the U.S. in January to perform his one-man show, Foreign AIDS, at Harvard's American Repertory Theater.